Coffee isn't cool. You know what's cool? Sparkplug coffee is cool. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica fair trade beans. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf, half-calf, and a rotating seasonal blend for those of you with adventurous tastes. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this splendid coffee to your home or office within 1 week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor, and you will taste the difference. You can order Sparkplug as you need it or join the Sparkplug Autopilot Coffee Club. The Autopilot Coffee Club is not a coffee of the month club. It's completely personalized and flexible and comes with all kinds of member benefits. If you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, and that's all one word with the number 100, Sparkplug is offering 20% off your next coffee order. That applies to any size order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. So what are you waiting for? It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
I'm just checking your math on that coffee promotion. Yes, I got the same thing.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Happy new decade, everybody, and thank you for joining us as we begin the fifth year of the Next 100 Project, the spinoff of the Top 100 Project. For a few years, we talked about the AFI's 1998 and 2007 Top 100 movies, but that mission was accomplished, so now we chat about things that compel us to do some chatting. And we spoil the pictures from their nose to their tiny little toes. Today is the first of three titles we'll feature in the month above as the Birthday Girl programs our schedule for January. I'm the excellent coder who chews on darts and betrays all of his friends, what few of them there are, Ryan Ellis. And here's the lover of apple teenies who thinks that marrying me was like marrying a Stairmaster. My wife, Bev.
That's me.
It's a great line, the Stairmaster line.
Oh, yeah. Right off the top, too. It really hit the ground running.
Okay, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture. The first of 2020, The Social Network, which was on both of our lists of the best movies of the 2010s. I had it number 10, you had it number 4 or 5
yeah,
or
four.
Something. Okay, there you go. All right, so how many people were signed up to Facebook when the movie came out, according to the poster, and how many people are signed up now?
The famous poster, to make 500 million friends, you have to make a few enemies, so it's 500 million. Mm-hmm. And now, the last I saw, and I think this may have been a 2018 number, it was 2.18 billion.
I just saw recently it says over a billion.
Oh, it's over 2 billion. Loosely, people like to say it's about a third of the world's population. Which is pretty hard to wrap your head around. There are more users of Facebook than there are members of the Catholic Church.
That's probably a good thing. Or is it a good thing?
I mean, like, I can't condone either of these organizations.
Yeah, probably true.
But I do have a Facebook account, so...
So maybe my numbers were very incorrect. Well, I was looking at this, though, too. Maybe this is also incorrect. Twitter and Instagram, can you guess how many they have? According to what I saw, maybe this is not right.
Oh, no, I've never even thought about it. I know it's a lot, but it's not nearly as popular as Facebook. Facebook is way more ubiquitous than
I thought they'd both be closer. Twitter says it's 330 million users.
Way smaller.
Instagram, 800 million.
When you use Twitter, it can feel like Twitter is the center of the universe. Only 18% of Americans have a Twitter account. The vast majority of Americans are not aware of the world according to Twitter, but it can have such a huge influence on media, really.
Speaking of influence, one of the big ones from this, I remember 2010, 2012, somewhere in there, and of course I work at the CBC in the news department specifically, and they would mention Facebook, and I wouldn't say it was snarky, but it'd be, well, Facebook said this. And then a few years later, Peter Mansbridge and all the other authoritative news anchors would say, like, it is a news source, and I guess for a while, it was a legit news source, maybe, maybe not. Anyway, the point is that they would start mentioning that, and they'd be given their Facebook, or probably more so their Twitter address. And not even 10 years ago, that would have seemed ridiculous to all of them.
I remember when news agencies first started using Twitter and Facebook as sources.
The kids do this. Why are we doing this? We're grown-ups.
Yeah, and it felt so embarrassing. But now, I think you can legitimately say, especially with Twitter, it's this direct line to people's quotes. When Trump tweets something, that's what Trump is saying. So, of course, it's news. It's true for any famous person or influential person on Twitter. They just speak through Twitter instead of through journalists, which is the way they would have done it before. More direct line, but it's a stranger relationship, for sure.
Maybe the story of the 2010s and some part of the 2000s, the aughts, whatever we call it, is social media. Partly because you can communicate with these people directly. Maybe it's not them, maybe it's an assistant. Sometimes you find a dummy account and you don't realize that. I'm sure I've done that where you think you're tweeting Michael J. Fox or somebody. Well, there's a big name I'm picking. Anyway, you think you're communicating. Well, then again, the big ones, you might remember their account. And the people that are regular tweeters, people that use it all the time, it's pretty hard not to find. A Kevin Smith, for example, he's that Kevin Smith. And if you go to his page, you're going to see all kinds of things. Yeah, he clearly said that, for example. But Martin Scorsese, I'm not really sure that's really ever been him. And if it is, I looked a few years ago, I started following him. But he doesn't tweet much at all, if ever. But anyway, the point is you can communicate with big-name people, including people like Trump, if you really wanted to. If he cared to, Barack Obama, I don't know if he communicates back with the people. But you can, and that's something you couldn't do, I don't know, 15 years ago at all. And now, of course, it is something that anyone in the world can do with anyone else if they really want to. Okay, so the next 178 project, which is the Facebook movie, was released going on 10 years ago by Columbia on October 1st, 2010. The picture doubled its budget at home and made a killing worldwide. I was one of the people that saw this on the big screen in 2010. So, Bev, remind people what the Facebook movie is about with the Facebook movies.
Jesse Eisenberg is Mark Zuckerberg.
Berg.
And you can put quotation marks around that, Mark Zuckerberg. The hopelessly awkward computer genius who invented the Facebook. During his rise, he's drawn in by the charisma of Justin Timberlake's Sean Parker and driven to turn against his only friend and the only real person to be listed as a consultant on the book that this film is based on, Andrew Garfield's Eduardo Saverin, leading to double lawsuits and a sour taste to Mark's meteoric success.
The Winklevi are part of the problem there, as they sue him also. Or in a nutshell, Erica Albright is a poopy head, but God, I wish she'd be my girlfriend again. Or, and that is the arc of the story, isn't it? Because it starts off with them being boyfriend-girlfriend and him being, he won't admit it, but destroyed that she dumped him. And at the end, he's trying to friend her. Although I was reading that everybody on the website, if you join, is a friend of Mark Zuckerberg. You have to be. My or for a nutshell, though, is rich kids get really rich creating a website that's now mostly used by old people. And misinforming my mother.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure we're not going to be able to avoid talking about the legacy of Facebook more so than the legacy of this movie, because this movie anticipated a lot of things, but I don't think that it really properly anticipated what the truly sinister thing. Probably the biggest villain in this movie, in real life, it only comes in at the end, and that's the venture capitalist who comes in with the money at the end, Peter Thiel, who's had tremendous influence on the website and is certainly responsible for the erosion of democracy.
Let's save that for a little later on. Let me do some numbers here. The Rotten Tomatoes critics love the movie. 96% of them said yes. 299 fresh, 14 rotten, for an average of 9 out of 10. Those are outstanding numbers. And 86% of audiences. And it is David Fincher's best-reviewed film on Rotten Tomatoes. Social Network won 3 Oscars for the screenplay by Aaron Sorkin, the editing, and the music score. And it was nominated for Best Picture, Best Director for Fincher, Best Actor for Jesse Eisenberg, his only ever nomination, the cinematography, and the sound. And all 5 of the people that won, so 3 awards, but 5 winners, 2 for editing, 2 for music, and it's Sorkin by himself, raved about Fincher, which they should. He is a very talented director. He's one of the best ones going in the last 30 or so years. But whenever you see him in the audience of that show, he's unsmiling. I wonder if he's nervous. There could be. I don't think it's true about him, because I think it's Sorkin that says he's also a great guy in addition to being a great artist. It could be that he's maybe jealous and a little pissed off. That's happened before, where directors are upset that somebody's up there, even if they're thanked by that person for daring to win. I don't know if that's really true of Fincher. He's been nominated several times and has never won. Of course, neither has Nolan and some of the better artists of the last couple decades. And Social Network lost all the major Oscars, picture, director, actor, to The King's Speech. And the movie was fine. King's Speech was not surprised it won Best Picture. But that was the same year. Even just discount Social Network. If the old people didn't get it, if the old members of the Academy did not understand the movie, Black Swan was nominated. Inception. They also wouldn't get that one, I guess. Or this one, Toy Story 3. And True Grit. But I think all 4 of those movies, and Social Network too, so all 5, are better than The King's Speech. But then that was a very common theme in the 2010s. We didn't really talk that much in our show last week about the Best Picture winners that we didn't include in our list or even mention them. Argo and The Artist and The King's Speech, I don't think we maybe mentioned that at all. And some of them were fine, but they weren't the best movies of the year. But a lot of people, I believe, last month in December when they did their Best of the Decade, were talking about this movie, as did we, as the very best of that year and one of the very best of the entire 10 years.
I actually saw a lot of people talking about Black Swan as one of the best of the decade as well. So that's two films. I like King's Speech. I think King's Speech is a very good movie. It's almost a crime that it usurped all these films for Best Picture, because I probably would like it much better if it wasn't such a crime that it won Best Picture. 2010 was a good year.
Fair enough. I'm not trying to shit on King's Speech, but in comparison. Well, anyway, let's go back to the movie at hand, The Social Network. What did you think of it this time? I guess you've probably seen it 3, maybe 4 times. I've seen it, I think, at least 4 times.
I've lost count. I'm sure I've seen it at least 4 times. I love this movie. I put it at number 4 on my top films of the decade list. I think it's a classic. I think it's likely to stand up as David Fincher's best film, which is a pretty phenomenal distinction. There's lots of competition there. Like most Fincher films, every frame is immaculate and intentional. Pacing is fast, it's really driving and relentless, really makes you pay attention. But I think the best thing about it is it strikes this perfect balance between its illustration of the gold paved path to hell and a deeply human empathy for the very flawed character of Mark Zuckerberg. And yes, I said character intentionally, because nobody is trying to pretend that this is an accurate portrayal of this person.
Mark himself said that they got his clothes right.
Yeah.
That's apparently all he said. So basically he's saying, you got nothing else right.
I own that exact fleece.
Well, that's Fincher for you, I guess.
Yeah.
Let me talk about one thing. I love this story. When Fincher made Gone Girl with Ben Affleck, who's also a director, of course, had won Best Picture as the producer of Argo. Didn't get nominated for directing it, but obviously did a good job directing it. He was a winner of Best Picture. And you talked about every frame being immaculate and intentional. Affleck apparently went to the cameraman and just barely adjusted a shot. Millimeters off of what Fincher had said it.
Ballsy.
Said, let's just see if he finds out if this has actually been changed. And of course, he noticed that minute little difference. I guess Kubrick would have probably noticed that too. But I wonder if other directors like a Spielberg or the Coens are that exacting. And especially the Coens can be pretty exacting. So there's that thing that I tip my hat to. I'm not criticizing Fincher in saying that. You do a lot of takes, including that opening sequence, which was 99 takes. We'll get to that in a second. But I do want to address the other thing you said there about the gold paved path to hell. We don't know what we thought about this website 10 years ago or even 5 years ago. But try to remember that time, just for the sake of argument. Is that fair to say it was the gold paved path to hell at the time?
Well, this is a movie about his path to hell in that he betrayed his friends. Not that he betrayed democracy, which he does. But yeah, this is the circle of hell he reaches in this part of his life. I think the movie's pretty outright in its opinion that he did a bad thing. He acted like a bad person, that his ambition got the better of him, and he chose the wrong path.
The movie portrays that because Eduardo got into the Phoenix Club, that's why Mark was pissed at him, and that's why he supposedly planned the story about the chicken. And it also seems like he betrayed Sean Parker and had the cops go to that party with the underage girls and all the blow. I think the reason why the movie portrays this, all the stuff we're talking about right now at least, maybe that's not true. Zuckerberg would surely claim none of it's true. But the movie suggests that that's what happens with Mark, and that he really gets in with Sean in the first place is because he wants to be cool.
It also is pretty strongly suggesting that he betrays the Winklevoss twins because of this one throwaway joke that Erica makes about how she likes guys who row crew.
I don't remember ever noticing that until this viewing, yeah. She says about the crew thing, she's not mentioning those two. I don't think they're even in her sight lines at all.
She says she's never even seen somebody who rows crew.
But I took a note about that because they're big guys physically. And of course, we see that later on with the Winklevoss twins, who are huge, especially compared to little Jesse Eisenberg. But they're also in a club, which Mark wants so badly, and they're just literally stronger than Mark. And as we find out with those two guys, they're better looking than Mark, and they're cooler than Mark. But let's address that part right now, about how he betrays the Winklevosses and Divya, Max Minghella, who's with them all the time, even when they go to London to row crew. Maybe he's involved with one of them, and they just don't want to put that in the movie. Maybe he's sleeping with one of them. But does Mark actually owe the Winklevoss twins anything? Did he steal from them?
No. It's definitely rude.
So you agree with that whole chair thing. If somebody made the chair and then I made a better chair, do I owe everyone ever made a chair?
It's not cool. It's not worth $65 million. I really do believe that the movie's making the point, and of course, my only perspective of this lawsuit and what happened between them is from this movie, so take that as you will. But he says the line, "The Winklevi aren't suing me for intellectual property theft. They're suing me because for the first time in their lives, things didn't go exactly the way they were supposed to for them." And I think in the movie language. That is exactly what happened. They gave him an idea, which in the end isn't really what he delivered. Yes, it was exclusive for Harvard, but it wasn't meant for people to meet Harvard guys, which was their whole thing, that they're like, oh, chicks will flock to this and we'll all meet women.
He took it international.
And I have to agree with his statement, as petty as it is, where he's like, if you were going to invent Facebook, you would have invented Facebook.
That's a simple line, but a good one.
I'm going to probably come back to this a few times because I feel like this story is so crucial to the arc of the film, which is a story that Sean Parker tells him about the founder of Victoria's Secret, who took an $80,000 loan, turned it into a $1 million business, sold it, I think, for $4 million, thought it was a happy ending. 2 years later, the company he sold it to had turned into a $500 million company, and he kills himself. How big is big enough? And there's the kind of people who can start a yogurt shop, maybe have a successful frozen yogurt shop. Good for you. There's that kind of people. And then there's the kind of people that Mark Zuckerberg wants to be, which is the person that he is now, an absolute titan of industry, one of the most powerful people in the world. And he's likely autistic, and he's definitely not elected. We definitely didn't choose him to have this much power and control over our lives. The Winklevi just think that that is their entitlement in life, but didn't have the gumption to do what he did. They were going to hire somebody to do what they wanted, but they don't really have his talent or his, I don't know what you even call it.
Ambition.
Ambition. Truly ambition.
It's an obsession. All about it. They have other things to do. They want a rogue crew. They're probably dating. He's not anymore.
They're studying for classes.
The movie never shows Mark with a girl after Erica dumps him in the beginning of the film.
Well, there's the bathroom thing, but that's pretty short-lived.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that.
Well, that turns into a relationship for Eduardo. There's never even a second date for Mark.
Yeah, right.
He just is like, oh, I have groupies.
Not portrayed, it's true. So maybe he's getting his fun here and there, but he's obsessed. He's always wired in, and he's working away at that. Okay, here's my answer for the Winklevoss thing. It reminds me a little bit of Whiplash, where I couldn't fully decide how I felt about it, despite all the viewings. In this case, I come out of it feeling like he does owe them a little bit of something, because it was more their idea than his, or at least combined ideas. But then again, even at this age, even a gentleman of Harvard, I think it's Cameron that says that, get a name on a contract. I do like how they portray, I think it's supposed to be Cameron, I couldn't really always tell, because of course Armie Hammer plays them both, and Josh Pence plays the body double, and they digitally put Armie Hammer's face on Josh Pence. But I think it's Cameron, who's the more reasonable one. He's the one saying we're gentlemen of Harvard and all that kind of thing. Until he finally is the one that realizes we've got to go after them, and you've written it down there, so say it.
Yeah, when they finally agree to go after Mark in federal court, they say, let's get the fucking nerds.
Then again, they don't say fucking. There's no swearing in this movie. He says friggin'.
Does he?
He says friggin' nerd.
But there you go. They're trying to be gentlemen of Harvard, but really deep down.
You push them far enough.
You push them far enough and they're like, get the nerds! Because that's truly who they are. And I can't imagine how you could come up the way that they came up. Tall, handsome, unbelievably wealthy.
And there's two of me.
Father with tons of influence. And there's two of me. Olympic athletes. What don't these guys have going for them? They get so many dressing downs in this movie, and it's so fun to watch these little child masters of the universe get torn down, but there is nothing that feels better than the scene where the president of Harvard is like, why are you wasting my time?
They have connections, that's why they're there.
Yeah, they think that they deserve something. That's the comeuppance that we all get to see. Of course, they went on to do just fine in real life. They are the people responsible for at least financing Bitcoin, and I'm sure have made insane fortunes by being the ground floor of Bitcoin. They didn't design it. They obviously aren't the programmer who invented it, but they were right there in the creation.
Well,
of
didn't
it.
Mark also settle with them? Isn't that what it says at the end of the movie?
Yeah, $65 million. They're coming from a family where $65 million is probably nothing to them, honestly. I'm sure that it was more their pride that was hurt.
Well, that's why, you know, I said in the secondary nutshell, rich kids get really rich.
Yeah.
All these guys are rich, including Mark and Eduardo.
Yeah, Mark Zuckerberg is in Harvard. I know he doesn't seem to have as much cash at hand as Eduardo does, who just made $300,000 on oil futures one summer. You don't make $300,000 without starting with a lot of money. So you know he's wealthy. Plus, you also don't get membership into the Phoenix Club without having a rich family.
Yeah, so I'm Mark sure. wasn't as rich as the rest of them, but he was still rich to be going to Harvard in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe got a scholarship. I don't know. I've never read up on the actual Mark Zuckerberg. And one thing we've talked about before, I forget exactly the context, but I want to say right now that just like in My Left Foot and Monsters Ball, the DVD covers were Daniel Day-Lewis and Halle Berry, whose characters look nothing like they do on the DVD covers. Smiling, styled hair, look happy. Those characters are nothing like that, especially Daniel Day-Lewis. Well, this one's not as disingenuous, but having Jesse Eisenberg smiling, I think the only time he ever smiles in the whole movie is the sequence where kids are drinking and also coding, and the two guys who do the best are, welcome to Facebook, welcome to Facebook. He smiles at Eduardo in that scene, and that's what's on the cover of the DVD. If it's not the one with the 500 million friends, make some enemies, that one. That's dumb when they do things like that, because that's a little more honest than My Left Foot on Monster's Ball, but this guy is not a smiler. It's one of those things, some movies that are, whatever, there might be a war film or something like that, does the character ever smile? That makes more sense. But this is a guy who eventually gets everything he could possibly want. Well, the movie says that he wants Erica Albright, and he doesn't get her at the very end. But he never really seems to smile except for that one time, so I thought I'd mention that. It was also shot in October 2009 in many parts of Massachusetts, but I don't think any of it was at Harvard. They used Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, which was standing in for Harvard. And they also shot a lot in California. And then when the guys go to Rogue Crew in England, that was in England.
What a great scene that is.
Mm-hmm. Great music, of course, yeah. And we got a hell of a tone set right from the beginning with that opening scene. 99 takes, apparently, is what they did. She's into him at first, I think. That's one thing I really noticed this time, that Erica seems like she's enjoying the fact that this guy's very smart. Maybe she liked him just as a guy. Maybe the sex was good with him if they ever had sex. I don't know.
Well, he talks about her boobs, so it's implied that okay. They were intimate.
And he pushes her away in the span of maybe 5 minutes. But when the conversation starts, it's all about him saying, there's more geniuses in China than any type of person in the USA. At that point, it seems like they're okay. Maybe being with him is like being with a Stairmaster, as she says. But it's a challenge in a good way until he starts being a deliberate dick.
Because I've watched that scene so many times and I've read the script for that scene, you know what it reminds me of? Do you ever really have a good conversation going on Instant Messenger? And then what happens is you kind of have two parallel conversations going on because in the time it takes for you to respond to something,
another thing's been said.
Bill writes something else, and then as they're reading that response, you respond to the other thing, and you'll have these parallel conversations in one conversation. If you're talking to somebody who's fast enough, I have a couple of friends in particular, my friend Julie, you'll know what I'm talking about, where every conversation with her is like that. She's just very fast thinking. I wonder if they did that on purpose, and it would certainly fit thematically when you're talking about Facebook and mm-hmm. messaging, and that's probably a lot of the ways that Mark Zuckerberg communicated.
I was reading, though, he even steals the face smash thing that he does before he actually starts doing Facebook. Another guy apparently compared people to farm animals in real life, so he stole that idea, too, or at least borrowed it.
Well, it's not like Facebook was an original idea. They don't really talk about this much in the movie. They mention MySpace.
There was a Facebook at Harvard. It was called the Facebook.
Facebook isn't really a Facebook in the traditional way that Facebooks were, which are basically like yearbooks.
It wasn't a website like this.
Yeah. But Facebook was just the next gen of MySpace, which was the next gen of Friendster. Mm. Facebook was the one that stuck, and I think that their innovation of the news feed is probably what really set it apart from other social networks. And that's the innovation that every other social network since then has copied successfully.
It might not be real, but Dustin, that's Joseph Mazzella, who's the kid in Jurassic Park. He's the one that prompts Mark to come up with the relationship status thing. Are you single? Are you dating? Are you married? All that kind of thing. Which can be very useful when you are on the website looking around for people, looking for old friends. And you're single like I was when I first joined, which by the way was March 2007. I was just looking earlier, scanning through 2007. I knew that was the first year, and I confirmed that, and I'm trying to find the month, and it took forever to find my first post where it looked like it was March. But back then, I was single, and when you want to find old friends, which was fun to do, some high school friends, and I guess a few college friends, are they married? Do they have kids? Out of curiosity, or because maybe they're available. And that, in the movie, is portrayed as a Dustin idea, and then Mark says to Eduardo, it's ready, and they go live at that point. Apparently Al Pacino was on the masthead back then. I was looking just earlier today trying to find wherever the actual homepage for Facebook is. And it just seems to take me to my own pages all the time. If I hit all the various things, the homepage is still my newsfeed.
You have to open up an incognito window and then you could see it.
Okay, because I haven't
seen
the masthead.
It's very bland now, but I did find the version of the old masthead. It is definitely Al Pacino.
I haven't seen the masthead in a very long time then. Okay, so it was. Hoo-ah, man. So while Mark is doing the face smash thing drunk and also hammering on Erica for being a poopy head, and he's ranking the girls, Eduardo even asks, which does show his character a little better than the other guys, do you think this is such a good idea? Nice touch there, because Eduardo is a victim in this movie, although I think you were the one that pointed out that when he did get a settlement, he didn't get as much money as the rest of the guys did, but he came out with many millions of dollars, wasn't it?
I can't remember what it was, but he did just fine. He made more money in that settlement than you and I will make combined in our lifetimes.
But even his 0.003% was still worth a lot of money.
Oh, yeah, it was 0.03%. So what is Facebook valued at now? That would still get him hundreds of millions of dollars if he still owns that stock.
Well, yeah, because if Mark settled, then I guess Eduardo didn't get more stock, did he?
And his name, they said, is still on the masthead at the end of the film, too.
And it should be. He was a benefactor. The website wouldn't have started had he not put in the money for it.
I did mention that he was the only person in the film who openly consulted on the book that this was based on. So we can take all this with a grain of salt, too. He comes across like a victim and a hero.
True. And it's also just Hollywood to make a victim and a hero.
Oh, yeah, you need that character and a bad to sympathize with. You know, this is the first time I ever saw Andrew Garfield in anything. Had you ever seen him in anything before?
No, he was new on the scene. He went on to do some big things, because right from this, he went to do The Amazing Spider-Man, the first one. And then since then, of course, he'd be the sequel to that, but also Hacksaw Ridge, which got him an Oscar nomination, the Mel Gibson movie. And then he works with Scorsese in Silence, which not many people saw, but still, you could say, I worked with Scorsese in this, not big movie, I guess, but anyway. So his career's been pretty good ever since. One of his best moments, I think it might be his last scene, where he says, I was your best friend, or your only friend. And Mark being Mark can't really react like a human being in that moment, which seems to be true of the real guy when you see him do things like talk to Congress.
Oh my God,
it's almost like Eisenberg got him more than we even realized, because I don't think I'd ever seen Mark Zuckerberg at that point, or even soon after the movie. Why would I? There's no reason to see this guy out in public or doing things. He isn't this much of an unloved person in reality, because he's been married for a long time now, has a kid and everything. And
we don't really know that much about him. He's a surprisingly private person. Ironically, he's a surprisingly private person. We have no idea how much of this is true. He just doesn't really open up about himself and his life.
Eisenberg, not Zuckerberg, but Eisenberg actually has OCD, so this took him back to a bad place. He did not want to have to do that, but he wanted the role. Got him an Oscar nomination. Big hit. Yeah, so he had to be OCD in a way. I don't know if Zuckerberg's really portrayed quite like that, but it's similar enough to Eisenberg. It'd be like if you stuttered and then you have to play a stutterer.
Mm.
Something like James Earl Jones when he was younger was a stammerer. So if you played that, it would take you back to a place you don't really want to go. Shia LaBeouf was talked about to maybe do the role, and as much as that guy takes shit for the way he is, would have been a pretty good piece of casting too.
Listen, he is an outstanding actor. Whatever he's like behind the scenes, I'm still grateful for the work. Whatever he puts people through who work for him. But damn, he is great.
Eisenberg had been in Zombieland before this movie, and then he did Lex Luthor not that many years after in the Justice League films. What was that? The Dawn of Justice movie, Batman vs. Superman. And he's been taken to task for playing Lex Luthor the way he did. But the one thing I'll say about it, not that I like that performance that much either, especially compared to Gene Hackman, but Eisenberg, kind of like Michael Cera, almost always plays Jesse Eisenberg doing another movie. Because Zombieland and Social Network are pretty similar characters in their own way. At least the way he played Lex Luthor was something different from what he usually does.
I've only seen parts of it because it seems awful, but Now You See Me, which made a lot of money, the first one, I don't think the sequel necessarily did. Isn't he playing like a charismatic magician?
I don't remember that much. But
I remember feeling like that was a stretch.
But I feel like he played it a lot like he plays Zuckerberg in this, just a little bit more open and out. Not
he's
out,
very
not that way.
And when I see him in movies where he's just playing out an out good guy, like Zombieland, I find him very endearing. It's really easy to root for him. He does express vulnerability very well, which I think is really important in this part where he's such an asshole.
He's not just trying to be. He is an asshole.
Yeah, but then when that vulnerability comes out, you really just see that, forgive me for the way I'm going to phrase this, but there's just a lonely little boy in there.
Oh, clearly. That's what the movie's showing, whether that's true or not. The movie also shows Mark has a wry sense of humor. Maybe that's Eisenberg and, of course, Sorkin's screenplay. Fincher's not really the funniest director of all time, so maybe more credit to Sorkin and to Eisenberg for playing it that way.
He can be funny. Look at Fight Club. Fight Club has so many great laugh lines. You can't accomplish that level of comedy without at least getting it. I think he just chooses to make more dour films.
I still wonder if Fincher gets Fight Club and what's really going on there. Or maybe I don't get it. But somebody's not getting something when I see that movie. But I wonder about the laughs thing, because there's laughs in this movie for sure. A lot of the way that Mark is, throwing beers against the wall when he's trying to give them to people. And again, not breaking a smile, not laughing. That would be funny. Or you'd be appalled that you have to clean up a mess. One of those two things. He doesn't really even react to the fact he threw a beer against the wall and it shattered and there should be liquid and glass everywhere. And we don't really know this, I guess, but does the real Mark have a sense of humor? Or is that one of the biggest fictions in this entire movie?
One of the lines that I wrote down in my section where I talk about him and women and his nerd misogyny is after people are outraged about Face Mash, what is his response? He goes, did everyone forget how to take a joke?
Very Trump-like in that way. I'm very funny.
I was kidding.
Yeah, you guys are known for your sense of humor. But the Mark in this movie is funny a lot of the times.
Yeah, well, he's biting humor, which is very much Sorkin. One of the reviews I read pointed out that Sorkin writes very well a smartest guy in the room who is unbearably arrogant and a thinly veiled narcissist. And sometimes that works perfectly, like in The Social Network, and other times it is horrible, like in The Newsroom.
Yeah, which after that pilot was never a good show after that. The West Wing was the first big thing he did. Well, I guess A Few Good Men and The American President, he wrote those screenplays. Because A Few Good Men was a play. It was the very first thing I think he ever did. And it became a movie, which I love and have seen many times, American President. Then The West Wing is a TV show. And you mentioned The Newsroom, which was marginally successful. But we talked about this only last week, because I mentioned it as one of my favorite movies of the decade. And that was Moneyball, which he wrote, adapting a book there. And he adapted Ben Mesrick's book, in this case, The Accidental Billionaires, was what the Facebook movie was. That was 2009, so just the year before. And that same guy, Ben Mesrick, also wrote the book that 21, I think it was called something else, but that movie Kevin Spacey was in was called 21. Maybe Chris and I'll cover that at some point, because we've covered Cards movies before. And I just said it, Kevin Spacey, one of the things with this movie, it's very tainted as well. It's not the movie's fault, but it's tainted by the fact that Facebook has become bad politically, and the fact that Kevin Spacey was an executive producer. And when one of the guys won an Oscar, I think it was Sorkin, when he went up there to accept Spacey's giving a standing ovation and gives him a hug or a handshake like that. Now, we can't pretend Kevin Spacey and Harvey Weinstein and Bill Cosby didn't exist. I hate when people do that kind of thing. No, can't ever talk about their stuff again. Or Chris Benoit in wrestling. Can't even pretend he existed. They did. These are big parts of pop culture for a long time, especially Spacey in more recent history. But it just is a little weird to see him in a prominent spot at the Oscars, but he was an executive producer on this movie, which is an interesting thing, because you wouldn't think Spacey was ever going to... Well, he wouldn't have been in it. What would he have played? He played Lex Luthor, though, interestingly.
Oh, yeah.
In the Superman Returns movie in 2006, and then Eisenberg plays him a couple years after this film.
Just quickly take it back to Sorkin. He said it was the fastest that he had ever said yes to anything. They gave him a 14-page book proposal of The Accidental Billionaires, and he said he agreed to do the script when he was on page 3.
Wow. He had a pretty good last several years of writing. Wally's Game was his first ever movie as a director, which wasn't great, but I thought it was solid.
It was very entertaining.
And he was nominated for an Oscar for that, too. So Moneyball...
Oh, no, it was Jesse Eisenberg. Michael Cera was in it, sorry.
Yeah, so Moneyball, Social Network, and this. And, of course, he won for this. Good speech, by the way, too. He also does mention Ben Mesrick, which is good. A lot of times people forget that their movie was based on some other property. In this case, he did not forget that. I want to go back to Eduardo, because he has to go through the frat initiation. We only see one scene of that. I hate that stuff so much. It's so stupid that we still do that. And I guarantee you, if you sat somebody down, maybe the person that's in charge of it for a different frat here and there, and said, why do we still do this? Well, because I went through it. Because we can never possibly change and do something differently. And even though it's only briefly in the film, but it is a big part of the film because he's pledging, I think, the Phoenix Club or anyway.
It's
that's
Phoenix, yeah.
Yeah, right. So he's pledging that. And the film portrays that Mark is pissed him for daring to be cool enough to be in their club. But I see that stuff, it just makes me so mad. But that's part of this, though, too. It's you're going to be cool if you're with us, if you do the things that you're supposed to do to be with us. That's not really what Zuckerberg did in the movie or has done with Facebook. It's not really about being cool, exactly. They do mention the word about it has to be cool. Can't be ads on it.
Keep saying it's cool. You got to keep Facebook cool. Now Facebook is just the antithesis of cool.
A long time now, too. It really is for older people way more so than
maybe popular,
the
but
kids.
It's not cool.
We mentioned 8th Grade last week, too. This is one of my favorite movies of the past decade. And apparently Bo Burnham was going to use that as the way they communicate with each other, all the kids. But then it was Elsie Fisher, the star of the movie, that pointed out, kids don't use Facebook, they use Instagram and Snapchat. So then he changed it to that. I didn't know that either. Well, I guess I knew that a few years ago, but up until 5 years ago, I thought that everybody that communicated online, primarily at least, because Twitter was getting big by then, 5 years ago, but I thought primarily it was Facebook, and even then that wasn't true.
All the 20-somethings I work with are almost exclusively Instagram.
But again, with our Eduardo, he is bad at schmoozing. And the scene with Sean Parker is in some ways the most important scene in the movie because you get a big star like Justin Timberlake, music career. I don't know if he had been at that point, but eventually would marry Jessica Biel. Wow.
For as long as they stay married. He's had a rough year. That's all.
Oh, okay. He was also nominated for a song for, what was that movie, Trolls? So he had a huge decade as well. But you get a cool guy to play. I don't know if Sean Parker in reality was cool, but in the movie he is. And Eduardo is so bad at just pretending to like him, which is kind of what he had to do as a CFO. Eduardo made a bad business deal with his own company. I think Mark even says that. Okay, that's true. But also, just swallow your pride sometimes. This is what you have to do in business.
And say what you want about Sean Parker, who comes across like a real scumbag. He gets them the venture capital that they need. He takes them to the next level and pushes Mark to seek that next level. So you could question, in the logic of the movie, would Facebook be what it is now if Sean Parker hadn't been there pushing and using his influence and name to get them forward?
They wouldn't be.
Eduardo, maybe the CFO, but he's not very good at it.
He's still a kid. They're all still kids.
Yeah.
Another big scene, because of course the four of them, Brenda Song is part of that too. She's in the movie only a little bit. I guess she blows them, like whatever it is, in the bathroom when she first gets with Eduardo, and then she's with them when they meet up with Sean the first time. And I think the only other time you see her is when she's burning stuff on his
bed.
She's a good-looking woman. I think she could actually play both psychotic and supermodel level at the same time.
Well, she is a psychotic supermodel in this movie. Isn't she exactly that?
She's a supermodel?
Well, she's hot. Hmm. But she's psychotic.
In that one scene, anyway. But the other big scene, apart from those guys at that bar, well, the restaurant, I guess, is the bar scene. You can barely hear them. It's an interesting touch to do that. We've seen so many scenes where people are at clubs. In The Shining, the ballroom scene, where Jack walks in the second time, and then he sees everybody's there. Apparently none of them are making a sound, and it's, of course, dubbed in later, all the post-production sound. And I read that online on the IMDb section of The Shining, and think, isn't that the way they do all those kinds of scenes? Isn't that just Kubrick with The Shining? Because I've heard in other movies where you've got a club scene, but not quite like this, but you've got to talk really loud! And yeah, just like we are right now, there's no other sound in the room.
I've never seen a film more accurately portray what it's like to try and have a conversation in a noisy club.
And barely make it out,
but you can still understand everything they're saying. It's so well done. Like, I have no idea how they did it, and I assume that most filmmakers have no idea how they did it, because it's never replicated. Usually most scenes that take place in clubs seem so phony, because people are just talking at their normal voice and not screaming into the ear of the person next to them, because it's the only way they're ever going to hear what they're saying.
Eduardo later freezes the account, which is also petty, and again, maybe because he's basically still a kid, he's 20-something years old. Then the friendship looks to be over, and it's a pretty critical moment in the whole film that he does it. I don't really blame him, but he could have talked to Mark a little bit more than he did.
But Mark wouldn't talk to him.
They weren't communicating very well, yeah. I mentioned I joined in March 2007. Do you remember when you joined?
Around that same time. I worked at my current job. I hadn't worked there for very long, but I started that job in 06. I'm guessing I probably joined in 07.
I still find the site valuable for a few reasons. One is playing Scrabble with people, including you and my mother and my aunt. And you do keep up with people's pictures. It's nice to remember people's birthdays. I'm bad with birthdays as good as I am with a lot of other dates. I'm always bad with birthdays, so Facebook helps with that. I'm not saying I ever want to quit the site, but it's getting tougher to want to be a part of something like this because of the fact that we now know that Russian bots and Russian agents, whatever, have bought time on their website. And he can't even deny it anymore. He basically says, meh. So that's what my What Happens Next thing is. Zuckerberg, the real guy, or even just the one portrayed in the film, shrugs and counts his money as foreign powers use his website to try to bring down his own country. Because that's what the Russians are trying to do. And that's not really Republican or Democrat. It's just the people in power, Republicans, the ones who shrug when it happens. Well, but that's like what Zuckerberg is doing. He's shrugging too.
Like I insinuated earlier, Peter Thiel is an incredibly influential venture capitalist. He is more or less single-handedly responsible for taking down Gawker Media because they said some mean things about him. So he bankrolled an elaborate lawsuit against them using Hulk Hogan. It's completely batshit. This guy is petty, and he is a Trump supporter, and I don't have a doubt in my mind that he would use all the power and influence that he accrues sitting on the board of Facebook with Mark Zuckerberg, who knows what he's really like, but he must be pretty easy to influence. Either that, or he is also a Trump supporter who believes in using some pretty underhanded methods to support the Republican cause.
I think the odds are good that's what it is, because people who have so much power and money want to keep that power and money.
Yeah.
And they're willing to accept a terrible person as their president because they want to keep their power and their money.
It benefits them. They're so influential. It is crazy to think how influential these masters of that industry have become. They're ambitious and they're smart. But they're also lucky, and they certainly are not chosen by the people that they are controlling. And it's really worrisome. Peter Thiel is one of them. Mark Zuckerberg is one of them. There's also Bezos and the Google guys.
Well, Sheryl Sandberg's part of that, too. The lean-in woman. She's part of this, too. She's still there.
I'm on feminist media all the time, and everybody takes her message with a huge grain of salt. And they've held her responsible for a lot of the stuff that Facebook has done.
So Rashida Jones is in the movie, not that much. This is the year after she was in I Love You, Man, which is still one of my favorite comedies ever. And she's one of the lawyers. She's involved with the lawsuit. And she has the line I quoted a minute ago. You're not an asshole, Mark. You're just trying so hard to be. And we said when the movie was ending at that point, no, he's earning the right to be called an asshole. The thing he's trying to be is cool and be accepted by people in these clubs. Again, the way the movie portrays it. Now, she doesn't know him that well, so maybe that's why she even says that at all. But she's one of the few female voices in the whole film because Rooney Mara appears, I guess, three times. The opening scene, where she's got maybe 5 minutes of screen time. Briefly, when the face mash thing is happening and she's shown tearing up, seeing that she's been embarrassed this way. And then when Mark meets up with her, and I don't know if he's even really trying to apologize, but Eduardo thinks he is. And I don't think we see Erica beyond that, apart from the very end, when you see that she's a Facebook member too, and he's trying to friend her. But I guess that already he can friend anybody. He does friend everybody because you joined his website. But there's not a lot of women in this movie. I don't know if it's really a misogynist movie exactly, but I see you have notes about misogyny, so I'll let you take it away. I lead you in by bringing up Rashida Jones and Rooney Mara, who've both become big since this movie.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Rashida Jones, she's more of a plot device than a character. There's really not that much to her. It's funny, I read more than one review where they described her as a law student, which is straight up inaccurate. She says that she's a two-year associate. It's funny that people underqualify her because she just seems naive and just so compassionate towards him when he doesn't really deserve it. Yeah, there's only a handful of women characters, virtually no women on screen who aren't hot. There's a couple of older women authority figures, but every co-ed is hot, and they are there to remind us what motivates these guys. The women in this film are both the things that they're obsessed with and repelled by, and when I say women, I mean beautiful women. Women that would never have been attainable had he not created this thing. And same with Eduardo, in a way, too. They're obsessed with them. They hate them. They do these terrible acts of misogyny, like the face mash thing. The language they use, a lot of the way that they just treat the women in their lives. It's a movie about men. It's about boys. One of the more insightful things about it is the way that it seemed to understand incel culture before the word incel even existed. They understand the way that these hopeless nerds who could never get a date, and we've always felt so sorry for them, but actually underneath this persona, instead of a pitiable but lovable guy who eventually is going to get the girl, what actually is under there is a simmering hate and a bruised ego and this desire to lash out and hurt women or own them or just treat them like garbage. Their inability to relate to women in a way makes them very, very cruel to women. And I think it's subtle in the film because it's not the main theme, but if you watch it carefully, it's everywhere. Like I said, every girl that they cast as an extra is gorgeous. The scene where he's writing the face mash code is intercut with the scene of the women being bussed into the Phoenix party. So they get gorgeous co-eds shipped to the party for the privilege of partying with these final club guys. And they're rich, so all these girls are taking their clothes off and they're doing coke off of their chests and they're playing strip poker and it's all very sexy. They're making out with each other. And I kind of wonder if that scene is really meant to be real or that's meant to be what's going on in Mark's head of what he thinks he's missing out on. So he's here creating this incredible website, and what's motivating him is the fact that all of these guys get to party with these beautiful women, and he doesn't get to be there.
It could be both. Could be real, and it could be imagination.
Just like any movie about bad people, there's probably a lot of people out there that watch the movie and don't get it, and just see it from Mark's point of view and don't understand what they're seeing. Kind of like Wolf of Wall Street, that there's just a bunch of people who watch that and are like, wow, Jordan Belfort is so cool. And there's probably people who think that about this film as well.
I think the bigger comparison is the same filmmaker, and we covered this movie a few years ago. It's Fight Club. Well, you talked about that right there. That's a lot like Fight Club.
Yeah, he has a really keen understanding of how the masculine brain or patriarchy can turn on men and turn them into these monsters, the way they are with each other, the way they are with women, the way they are in society, and this need to lash out because patriarchy convinces them that they're either entitled to something or that they need to be masters of the universe. Again, I'll reference that Victoria's Secret story. $4 million isn't enough for that guy. $4 million isn't cool, but $1 billion is cool. The consequences of not being a billionaire are death. That guy killed himself. Their ambition is so extreme, and their idea of the consequences of failure to reach that standard are so unreasonable that they drive themselves to behave like fucking maniacs.
Do you think Fincher has contempt for all of this? I don't think he has contempt for his own movie.
No, I think he has empathy for these guys. He sees that it's not a good place to be. In this movie, underneath everything that Mark does, you do see this sad little boy. I think he has empathy for the people who are stuck in this pattern of behavior and honestly can't see the forest for the trees. They behave poorly. I actually think Fincher has a really keen understanding of that and portrays it. I wouldn't like him as a filmmaker if he didn't know what he was doing, because I wouldn't be able to tolerate
I'm not suggesting
gross behavior.
I'm not suggesting he doesn't know what he's doing, even though I may have said that on Fight
No,
Club.
But he understands and empathizes with the villains in his film. There's always some aspect of people behaving badly in
part
his
reason,
movies.
Part of the reason I ask if he has contempt is because I don't think he, Eisenberg, or Sorkin our Facebook members, or were after this movie came out. Eisenberg apparently created an account, and then he closed it right after the movie came out because he didn't want to be part of it. Didn't really care. I can see why people don't care about that kind of thing. And looking back at my old post, you see the number of times it would be, back then it was Ryan Ellis is. And I wasn't as bad as some people I know, but I would post maybe not daily, but a few times a week. And who cares? And maybe Eisenberg and Sorkin and Fincher are the same kind of people, which is, I don't need to share every little thing I've ever done. And we know people who have done that, that share every thought they've ever had on that site, even now, and certainly back several years ago.
It's been a real evolution of the way people use Facebook, because, yeah, at first everybody was really oversharing, and then there was a backlash to that, and then everybody kind of reeled back. And there's been these waves of the way that people share and the way that they're told that they're stupid for the way they share. Now, the only people who still really actively share on Facebook are brands and ants. That's my Facebook feed, at least. And I don't think I would use Facebook very much at all. You say that you really love playing Scrabble. There's certainly a couple people that I like to just peripherally keep in touch with. But what's really kept me sucked in, and the reason I think I'll never be able to cancel my Facebook account, is that I love the convenience of being able to sign into other websites with my Facebook account. You need to set up an account somewhere, and they're like, well, you could just click on that Facebook button, and then we'll just do it through that. Would I lose all that if I cancel my Facebook
account?
That's part
of the
privacy. I'm going to have to start with scratch.
Part of the privacy problem. They're into too much stuff, I think.
The convenience sucked me in, and I regret it now, but at the same time, I still do it. It's just so easy.
So we talked about Eisenberg and Garfield. Timberlake a little bit as well. Armie Hammer, if he'd been anything before this, I don't know what it was.
I never knew who he was before this.
I think he's pretty good in this movie, especially playing dual roles. And I think he does give the two twins different character types, unless I'm misidentifying which one's Cameron and which one is Tyler. Maybe I am. But he went on to do The Lone Ranger, and nobody liked that movie. But then most people who've seen it, at least, love Call Me By Your Name. And then John Getz is Zuckerberg's lawyer. He was in The Fly many years before. And we can't forget Dakota Johnson, the Shades of Grey actress, who's not very good in those films, because they're not very good films. But in her small role here, she's pretty good.
What about Rooney Mara? I never heard of her before this film.
Well, I mentioned Rooney Mara.
Oh,
already,
yeah, but this movie made lots of stars.
Wanted to be in Dragon's Tattoo, that Fincher directed. That was one of his biggest hits. It might be, actually, no, his biggest hit is Curious Case of Benjamin Button, I believe.
Oh, and this time is the first time watching this film that I spotted Caleb Landry Jones. I don't think I knew who he was before this time watching this film, because I didn't really know who he was before. Was it 2017 that
Get Out
and Three Billboards, Twin Peaks The Return? He's one of the frat boys who gets busted with coke.
Yeah, this movie's a bit of a star maker.
Also, the first film scored by Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, which is incredible because it's an outstanding score. It won the Oscar.
You liked it, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I did like it. The pacing is so relentless and the score really gets that. And I actually do like Trent Reznor's scores. I loved Nine Inch Nails when I was like a brooding teenage girl, so maybe that has something to do with it.
And one of Reznor's songs is in Seven, Closer to God, plays in the opening credits of that. Yeah, they both work with Fincher quite a lot. They did the music, I think, for the movies he did soon after this, Dragon Tattoo and Gone Girl. I don't know if they did the music for that. But Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, I'm pretty sure they did the music for that one. And like you say, they won the Academy Award, as did Kirk Baxter and Angus Wall for the editing, partly because you got the intercutting with the depositions with Eduardo and the Winklevi. Maybe because I've seen the movie four or even five times, I always know where I am. But it's not confusing at all the way that's edited. Baxter and Wall mostly work together, it seems like, and Baxter has two Oscars because they won, or at least he did, for, I think, Dragon Tattoo won an Oscar as well, didn't it, for the editing? And the cinematographer, Jeff Cronenweth, who's Jordan's son, the guy who shot Blade Runner. Cronenweth, Jeff, that is, has worked with Fincher four times, including on Fight Club. We watched the Blu-ray, the 239:1 Blu-ray. It looked pretty solid. What'd you think of the look, the cutting, and the music you just said you liked?
It's a David Fincher film. The technicals are outstanding.
It's a very highly technical film, actually, partly because of the Winklevi thing.
Sure, and I think he used the same technology that he helped invent for Benjamin Button, the face mapping. But it looks outstanding and immaculate. He is so great with editing. This is a pretty hard story to tell, and they really did it right. And the pacing, it's relentless. You always feel like you have to catch up with it.
Yeah, in a movie like this, some other director may have made it seem, maybe not dull, but just not quite so urgent.
They're coding. How do you make coding look exciting?
Well, people complained about The Net way back when, that Sandra Bullock was in. It's a movie about a woman online, so they turned into this whole big life-threatening drama when it didn't really need to be that. This has no real stakes. It's about money. It's not about people living or dying. But yeah, they do make it seem more like Seven was, which was also well-edited and was also nominated for an Oscar. And that had an urgent thing because, of course, people are dying. And Kevin Spacey, working with Fincher here as they work together on House of Cards, was the star, well, one of the stars of Seven. We never did cover Zodiac, which I like a lot. You're not a big fan of. You do like Gone Girl. We thought about doing that last year, but didn't. And the man's Kubrick-esque, I would say. He's a very exacting director. We talked about that at the start of the podcast. His producers, a lot of them are on this one. Scott Rudin, who won an Oscar for No Country for Old Men a few years before this, and a lot of people would say he should have won a second one for this movie. And also Dana Brunetti, who I believe is a Spacey partner in his company, Mike DeLuca, and Sion Chafin. Thank you to Aaron Sorkin for pronouncing that in his Oscar speech, so now I know how you say that name. So we've raved about Fincher, we've raved about the story, we've had our issues with their actual product that they're talking about, Facebook itself. It's not something that matters in any way if we ever actually had an apocalypse. And I think Eisenberg says in Zombieland something like, you don't have to worry about Facebook status updates anymore. Ironically, going to make this movie the next year. I don't think he knew then he was going to be in the film.
You work on TV. Do you make something?
No, I don't. One of the reasons why my job to me doesn't mean what it could is there's nothing. It's just air.
I'm going to say I disagree with you on that whole philosophy, that it's not something because it's not something you can hold in your hand.
Well, I kind of...
You can't hold education in your hand, but that's
I agree
something.
With Billy Crystal to a degree when he talks about that in City Slickers, when he talks about being in radio as an advertising guy or something like that. It doesn't mean anything to him. Obviously, it means a lot to Zuckerberg.
This podcast isn't something.
True.
Can't hold this in your hands.
Yeah, okay. And this does mean something.
I found it.
It costs me money.
In your armor.
I like the job that pays me money. In 7 days, we'll have a super fun time as we tackle Requiem for a Dream. One of those films I've seen many times, but you don't need to see it many times because it is hard viewing, and that is a compliment to it. The coming attractions trivia for Requiem for a Dream. This is going to be an opinion thing. What's the one addiction, because we all have at least one, that you could never, ever give up?
All right, for the answer to that question, check out our next podcast about Requiem for a Dream. In the meantime, you can check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe or favorite the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify, where hundreds of episodes of the Top 100 Project are available for free. And that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 list of the best American films ever made, and many, many more titles on top of that. In exchange for all this great content, perhaps you could leave us a rating and a review. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I'm at BevEllisEllis. Ryan is at MovieFiend51. You can email us top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And to enjoy freshly roasted premium coffee delivered straight to you, please go to sparkplugcoffee.com and use the promo code top100project, and that's all one word, top100project, and it's not case sensitive, for a 20% discount.
I think we should go to Paul Scheer and Amy Nicholson and sue them for doing the AFI movies that they've been covering for the past couple years.
$65 million.
We did it first. I don't think we did it first. But we did it best. We looked before we started doing this.
We hope you agree, listeners.
We looked before we started doing the podcast years ago, and no one else had done all of them. Somebody had done some of them, but they did them so infrequently.
Petered out, so we're like, okay, we're not really straight up copying anybody else.
We never petered.
But we're not the only ones anymore.
So Paul and Amy, we're coming for you.
Oh, yeah.
We want at least $20. Maybe $40.
And cut.